Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. It is Friday morning, January the 7th, 2021. And my guest.
John, it's 2022.
Oh my God. You know, I always have trouble with the date. You are right. It is January 7th, 2022. And my return guest, Dubai-based lawyer, U.S. tax lawyer, Virginia Latorre-Jaker, who I often think of as the world's favorite tax lawyer. And all of these interesting discussions. And this is really part of our, I think, expatriation series that we're doing. And today we're going to focus on a very niche issue, but one that is of importance to a lot of people. And specifically, that is to kind of frame the issue. As you know, if you're a U.S. citizen and you sell a principal residence, there are certain circumstances under which you would be eligible for a $250,000 exclusion on the capital gain, or $500,000 if you are filing jointly. However, if you expatriate, and you are a covered expatriate, the question arises as to whether you do, in fact, still get that $250,000 exclusion. And to understand why that is, I think I will punt this over to Virginia for the moment. Virginia, what is the provision in the Internal Revenue Code that creates the possible problem here?
Right. The provision is Code Section 877 capital A, which talks about the covered expatriate's exit tax, so we call it, or mark-to-market tax, which many of your listeners are probably aware of it. But just to review quickly, what happens to a covered expatriate when he is expatriating is that he's deemed to sell all of his worldwide assets on the day before he expatriates. So it's a pretend sale of everything he owns on that date. And of course, if he's living in his own home, he's treated as if he is selling that home. And our $1 million question is, when we calculate this exit tax on the deemed sale of the home, for example, are we entitled to take this exclusion amount for the principal residence sale that is available if you were really selling your home?
Okay, so
So
we agree that if you were really selling the home, you will actually get that exclusion. And I think it's important to get into our conversation that this is because of Section 121, which is in a part of the Internal Revenue Code that lists specific exclusions to income, specific exclusions. Mm-hmm. Okay, now what 877A says, all right, with respect to the mark to market, to just read this in, it says all property of a covered expatriate, so remember this applies to covered expatriates, shall be treated as sold on the day before the expatriation date for its fair market value. Here's the problem though, the problem provision, Section 2, in the case of any sale under paragraph one, and would you agree this is the problematic language, notwithstanding any other provision of this title, any gain arising from such sale shall be taken into account for the taxable year of the sale. Would you agree that that's the culprit right there, that section?
That's the troublemaker, that little bit right there.
All right. So let me just read that again for listeners. Notwithstanding any other provision of this title, and you and I would agree that another provision would be the Section 21 exclusion, 121 exclusion, agreed?
Yes.
Yeah. Notwithstanding any other provision of this title, any gain arising shall be taken into account. So that could be read, I suppose, as being an override to the Section 121 exclusion. And you and I both know people, okay, who are in this profession, who have raised that question.
Of course,
And it seems to me that there are conflicting views on the answer to that. And I think it would be useful to explore what we think the possible considerations and answer would be.
Mm-hmm.
So let me begin by asking you the following question to sort of set the stage. Would you agree that the purpose of the exit tax is to collect tax on things that would be taxed if the person remained an American citizen?
I think that's a fair statement. Yes, John.
Is there any indication that you've seen that the purpose of the exit tax rules is to create tax in a situation that would not have been taxable if they remained an American citizen?
I can't think of something directly, but I can think of something that's a little bit of an indirect measure. I'll give you what I have in mind. The transfer tax provisions, which are part of the expatriation regime, will tax the recipient of a gift or a bequest from the covered expatriate at any time in the future at a flat 40% rate. That's the current rate that will be taxed on the gift or the bequest that the U.S. person recipient receives from the covered expatriate. That rule does not look to what the value of the asset may have been at the time of expatriation and say, okay, this asset you've inherited was worth X amount, and therefore you're going to pay this 40% transfer tax on the X amount. That provision looks to whenever the asset was transferred. It could be, 30 years after the individual has expatriated, that the U.S. person, family member perhaps, will receive a gift or a bequest from the covered expatriate, and that particular asset will have appreciated significantly in value post the expatriation. The code doesn't care about that. They tax at the time of the gift or bequest. And to me, that is terribly unfair because they are taxing something that has been completely outside of the U.S. tax regime for, perhaps decades. The value has gone up. So I think that provision might be catching exactly what you're talking about in terms of, is it taxing something that would not have otherwise been taxed if the person was still a U.S. person?
Yeah, well, you're right. That is a very, very interesting point. And while we're on that particular topic, this is precisely why when the issue of expatriation arises, one has to consider the status of the whole family, right?
Absolutely.
Because if you have a situation, I think you and I both see this all day, every day, right? A situation where, say, a parent, let's imagine, relatively modest, let's say, owns a piece of property worth $5 million, happens to be a covered expatriate, has children that remain U.S. citizens. If that particular piece of property is worth $100 million when that person dies, that means, and he or she leaves that to the children, that means the children are paying a 40% tax on the value of that. So this is, the only way out of that is really for the whole family to expatriate, right?
Yes, but that's easier said than done.
Often it is, but at least the goal is clear. Okay.
But that's the only incident I can think of where the expatriation regime is taxing something that it would not have otherwise taxed had the person still remained a U.S. person.
Okay, and that is, though, a very, very new and specific section of the Internal Revenue Code, right? That was clearly created for this purpose. This other section in 877A seems to me, I mean, you and I would both agree, I think, that 877A is one of the most sloppily pieces of legislation ever. Would you agree with that, or is it just me who sees it that way?
It's very poorly drafted, and I believe this is the problem that occurs when a code section, which is so high profile, such as this one, the law changes in various times in history to catch up with whatever is the latest happening in this entire area of people leaving behind their citizenship, for example. The drafters don't look and see what other sections are being impacted. So you may have an old law that still is being referred to in the new law, and yet there's glitches that are not addressed. And I think that this is one of them. And we'll, I'm sure, discuss that a little bit further when we compare the old law and this exclusion provision under Code Section 121.
Yeah, or, you know, to put it simply, it seems to me highly unlikely that anybody did consider the effect of this on the principal residence exclusion. And it's not even clear when you read it that it would apply to this. But okay, so you and I, for reasons, some of which overlap and some of which are different, based on our previous discussion, appear to be of the opinion that somebody expatriating should get the benefit of the 121 exclusion. Is that correct?
I think, John, an interpretation that we could follow will give you that result. So let's maybe look at two possible interpretations of that troublesome language that you read to us earlier. The notwithstanding any other provision of this title, any gain arising from a mark-to-market sale shall be taken into account for the taxable year of the sale. So one way you could interpret that language is to say you have all of your taxable gain on the deemed sale of everything that the person owns, and it shall be fully taxed. The only permissible exclusion is this special amount permitted by that code section 877A. And so for 2022, the excludable amount is $767,000. So one interpretation is deemed sale of everything, including the personal residence, and then you get to exclude this special amount provided by code section 877A. That's one way. So you don't even look at the section 121 exclusion, because that view, that interpretation says it's overridden. Another interpretation, which I think is the one you and I would favor, is it's merely an instruction for calculating the taxable gain on the deemed sale of everything the person owns worldwide, including the personal residence, and then permitting the use of the exclusion under section 121 to reduce that cap, that taxable gain, by the $250,000 or $500,000 amount. And then if they're filing jointly, and then any remaining taxable gain is further reduced by the section 877A permissible amount, which is this year $767,000. So we do not have, in anything I have read, any guidance on which interpretation should control. There's, you know, we don't have regulations under this code section. We have an IRS notice that was issued in 2009. It is a very long and lengthy notice, but I do not see anything in there clarifying this issue. If you look at the form 8854 and its instructions, there's no clarity on this issue. So really, you are left in a position of trying to advise a client when you don't have much to go with.
Right. Okay, so I think it's very, very clear for listeners that what we're talking about here is not fail-safe at all. Okay, it's just our general view. So anybody, any covered expatriate who is expatriating and has a principal residence, at the end of the day is going to have to decide, you know, whether they're willing to do this subject to some risk or not, I suppose.
Well, I think what the person can do is look at saying, let me sell my house before I expatriate. And then I clearly know I'm going to get the Section 121 exclusion amount. In the real world, I know that sounds great, like to just advise the client, well, sell the house before. But in the real world, people living in their homes in Canada or wherever they are don't want to sell their house. They want to remain living there. So that's a practical problem.
Well, not only that, there are significant costs to selling a house.
That's right.
As well.
And so, they may be taxed in the foreign country where they're living on the sale that they don't want to sell anyway. But if they're looking at this is a possible escape from the problem to sell the home, they're going to maybe be faced with a tax in their country where the home is located. So,
let's give some practical numbers here. So, if it's $250,000 of gain that's potentially taxable at what I guess 23.5% at current rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's long term. So what we're talking about is saving about $50,000 in tax, agreed?
Yes.
Yeah, under a worst case scenario. And I mean, there are people who could easily spend that just in selling their home, you know, in some way or another, right? So I am not sure that the advice, sell the home, is practically speaking, great advice. I think people may be better off just taking the position that they do get the exemption and deal with the blowback should it occur. Does that make sense to you?
It sounds like a possibility. I think what the wise taxpayer would do is to fully understand what the risks are. If he takes the position that he's entitled to the 121 exclusion when he computes the exit tax, and then understand that it is a risk and what's the worst case scenario that could happen there. And, you know, if he's deemed to be non-tax compliant, well, maybe he's a covered expat anyway. That's not going to be a huge concern for him. If you
understand. Well, but this would apply only for people who are covered expatriates.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. He's going to say, well, I'm a covered expat anyway, so...
Right.
So what else
right.
can happen to me?
Yeah. So I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe there'll be accuracy related penalties, something like that.
I couldn't imagine a penalty on something like this. I mean, it's so.
Well, certainly, you'd argue that no penalty should apply.
Yeah.
You can't guarantee that one won't.
You know, another point that I think should be made here is that, you know, there is the $767,000 exclusion anyway, right? So it may well be, I mean, just depending on, you know, people have such different situations. I mean, it may well be that it doesn't make any difference anyway, because their, you know, their capital gains are not above the $767,000 or whatever it is, right?
Well, we have to remember that exclusion amount per the notice 2009-85 is calculated in a very specific way. In other words, you don't just say, well, my total capital gain would be X, and I minus $767,000. That amount is allocated per asset by a special formula. So the individual should have actually a pre-calculation done and see where does he fall? And, you know, is it worth it for him to take a risk on claiming the 121 exclusion if he's going to be taxed? So,
well, a person, so it's only an issue if the person's a covered expatriate. If the person's a covered expatriate at $250,000, we're talking about $50,000 of tax. You know, against that, I think one needs to weigh, you know, going back to this discussion about selling and stuff like that, one needs to weigh, and I think this is particularly a problem for Americans abroad, right? I mean, they're the ones who are not going to be moving. You know, I think you have to look at what the actual cost to sell something would be. I mean, my God, I mean, you've got the general fix up, you know, the cleanup, the real estate commissions, and who knows what else. I mean, I just don't think that, practically speaking, unless you're somebody who's in the United States, who's a dual citizen and getting ready to move from the United States anyway, right? I mean, this would be the person, right? A dual citizen getting ready to move, expatriate, move out of the United States to their country of second citizenship. They're leaving the United States anyway. You know, that type of person, it's probably worth selling before, you know, before the expatriation, or at least considering. Mm-hmm. You know, the type who mostly I think both of us work with are people who live outside the United States. And this is where, you know, it becomes a much, much bigger problem.
That's right. Okay. But yes, okay. I think as a practical matter, certainly taxpayers should be looking at using the exclusion amount and dealing with whatever issues they may be faced with if they're penalized, et cetera. Or, you know, just saying, well, I'm not going to take it and pay the tax.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, you had some interesting points coming back to, you know, we sort of talked practically about what the seems to be a reasonable approach. Let's go back to the theory of this a little bit, though. You had made some points in our earlier conversation based on the old 877 as to why your view is that people should get the exclusion. Do you want to elaborate on that a bit?
Sure. Okay. As we've mentioned, this code section, the expatriation regimes, have changed over the years several times. And prior to June 17th, 2008, we had just code section 877, not capital A. So 877 was the old section, and it applied to those who expatriated on or before June 17th of 2008. And under that regime, it was very, very different. We did not have any kind of exit tax. There was no mark-to-market at all. What we did have was the expatriate being followed. If he was a covered expatriate under those rules, he would be followed by the US tax man for a 10-year shadow period after expatriating. And he would be taxed only on certain items of US sourced income that the average, the normal non-resident alien who was not an expatriate would not have been taxed on. So for example, sales of US securities, if you are just a normal non-resident alien, you would not be taxed on the sale of your US securities. But if you were someone under this covered expatriate regime, I think that would be an item of US source income that you would be taxed on for the 10-year shadow period. Now, in that old code section, there was specific reference to this section 121. And it said that you would not, if you were one of these covered expatriates under that provision of the code, the old provision, you would not be entitled to have the 121 exclusion. There was a specific denial of the exclusion for the personal residence on any expat who was subject to those provisions under the old law. Now think back, we are not talking about someone who had a pretend sale. That concept did not exist back then. So we were talking about a covered expat who sold or exchanged his personal residence. Okay, he's not entitled to it. And if you think about the new law, Congress didn't make any mention of this prohibition. So they could have easily amended this code section 121 on the principal residence to prohibit its application, even for those who were expatriating after this June 17, 2008 date. And nothing was done. So maybe it was an oversight, but They've had certainly plenty of years in between to amend and make it clear, and they haven't. So I think that this strengthens an argument that the person should be entitled to that 121 exclusion amount on the deemed sale of the principal residence.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So, you know, if we look at all these considerations, both individually and collectively, it seems to me that they add up to a conclusionary whole, if you will, that's greater than the sum of the parts, right? Because when we look at the various aspects of it individually, we believe there are arguments that people are entitled to the exclusion. But, you know, when we have, you know, 2, 3, 4 of these things, I think it strengthens it. Mm-hmm. But it is unclear, like so much of this stuff, and it's dealer's choice. You know, you make the decision with your advisor on how you want to treat this at the time of expatriation. Of course, the best thing is to not be a covered expatriate at all, because then this issue doesn't come up. But that is becoming increasingly difficult in an inflationary world to achieve. You know, on this issue of principal residences, this is generally becoming a bigger and bigger issue. A few years ago in Canada, the Income Tax Act of Canada was actually amended to require the inclusion in terms of information reporting. An information report if you sold your principal residence to be filed with your tax return. And this, of course, created a tremendous moment of awakening, rude awakening for U.S. citizens living in Canada, because the way they typically get their taxes done is they get their Canadian taxes done, where, of course, there was no record of a sale of a principal residence, and now there is. And then they would give it to their U.S. tax preparer, who before would not have known anything about the sale of a principal residence, but now does. And oh my God.
Right.
So this is a problem in general, I think, isn't it?
Yes, it is a problem, John. And I think we should add here that it's possible some information reporting may be done regarding the sale of the principal residence just by the U.S. person, not the guy in Canada who's a U.S. person. So, for example, there's a Form 1099-S proceeds from real estate transactions that the seller might get. And if he does get that form, then he has to report the sale of the home, even if the gain from the sale is fully excludable. And this Form 1099-S would probably, you know, be sent by the buyer's attorney.
Hmm.
There's also a reporting obligation, I believe, under Schedule D of the Form 1040 that's required if you cannot sell, if you can't exclude all of the capital gain on the sale of your home. So it's possible that there may even be some reporting on the U.S. side that might trip somebody up with that final tax return that's due the year after expatriation.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I mean, do you think the conclusion is that people should not bother having a principal residence at all? live in the streets or something? Or do you think they're going to require insurance if you live in the streets?
That might be the ultimate, but I don't know, John, what to say on that. Becomes more and more difficult to grapple with by the day.
Yeah, well, I think everything becomes more and more difficult. I mean, so in your family, you are, of course, a lawyer. So you're living in a family that has a lawyer, namely you. Do you think, Virginia, that it is possible to survive in the world anymore without at least one lawyer in the family?
Not realistically, no. And the bigger problem is, even if you have the lawyer in the family, the laws are so complicated. It's like you have a doctor in the family. But, you know, he may not be a brain specialist. So if you have, you know, a problem with your brain, some kind of tumor, he's not going to be able to know what to do. He's maybe a GP or he's a nephrologist who specializes in kidneys. It's the same in the legal world.
You know, it certainly is.
We know everything. We don't, even in the tax world. I specialize in, you know, a lot of foreign type transactions. So people will ask me a tax question that's strictly domestic. And I haven't dealt with that area for years and years.
Yeah. Well, and of course, even if you have, you know, I mean, it's changing all the time. You know, in North America, the Western world in general, you know, people have been having fewer and fewer children. Maybe this will mean that people have more and more children because at birth they can be designated as certain specialists. You know, this child has become a specialist in tax. This one's a specialist in this. This is a specialist in that to protect the family.
It wouldn't be a bad thought.
At some point, this has got to collapse under its own weight, I think. It is so extraordinary because it seems to me that the fundamental principle that's required for any tax system to have legitimacy is that people need to be able to know what's expected of them. Would you agree? Mm-hmm. Whether it's fair or unfair, you know, and when we have these discussions, we look at this stuff, it's so clear that people cannot know what's expected of them. So much of this just becomes a judgment call. You know, I have to do something, so I'll do this or I'll do that.
That's right. And the even sadder part, John, is that until very recently, things the IRS itself would post on IRS.gov were not something that taxpayers could rely on. Forms, instructions, certain publications, FAQs, and they could be penalized if they relied on them, and later the IRS changed its viewpoint on that particular area. So the Taxpayer Advocate Service brought this to the fore and said, look, you know, we have taxpayers that are relying on what the government tells them in an IRS website. And then when the government changes its viewpoint, says, well, we're going to hit you with an accuracy related penalty or a negligence penalty or whatever for not having done this correct. Oh, yes, you did rely on it, but we took that post down from the website. So too bad.
Well, so some practical advice clearly is that when you're dealing with these problems and filing your returns, you obviously print off whatever's on the website at that particular time, right?
You do, but that still doesn't mean you can rely on it.
No, but it opens the door to reasonable cause, at least.
Of course, it helps you. Yeah. Always print it out, always print it out. But it just goes to show you, with your point, that a tax system on which people cannot understand what's required of them or cannot even rely on what the government tells them is required of them is a pretty scary proposition.
Well, you know, particularly given a world where a tax system is about way more than tax, right? I mean, it's an expression of how a country views retirement financial planning. It's a way to distribute benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so much bigger than tax that, you know, it seems to me it's absolutely essential that people understand what's required of them. And the only way to do that, I think generally, and I'm not talking about just the U.S. tax system, okay, where I sit in Toronto, Canada, there are many of the same problems. But I think the time has come to break these things and start all over and, you know, rethink what taxation even should be. Because, you know, I think the United States at the moment has a number of separate tax systems. It's more like, who are you? And we'll tell you, you know, what are the rules that apply to you?
Yeah.
Terrible problem.
Absolutely.
Well, okay. This has been another interesting exploration into the world of uncertainty in U.S. tax. And do you have any closing pieces of wisdom for people?
I don't. I'm at a loss for words, really.
Well,
I think the one thing they can do
is before you leave for leap, perhaps.
I think what they should do is make sure when they're getting tax advice that they are well informed on their own, you know, from perhaps reading reliable sources such as information on my website or other reliable sources, so that they can be asking good questions when they go to their tax advisor or when they're looking at their tax return. I know people hate to hear that. They always feel like, well, I relied on the professional. They should know what they're doing. Yeah, good luck with that. You know, the IRS doesn't really buy that argument either if you're trying to escape penalties. So I think people have to really take the bull by the horns, especially in the area of expatriation, and know the right questions to ask. They have to be informed fully before they just sign off on a return.
Yeah, I think also I'd go maybe a step further. They need to understand what the consequences are of, let's say we're looking at, you know, taking this 121 exclusion. What does it mean to do so? What does it mean if it doesn't work?
Mm-hmm. You know, so, that's right. That's right.
I mean, I think that there's a constant sort of, you know, risk assessment. Although I must say that after this conversation with you, I'm inclined to think that, you know, the cost of doing things like selling in advance is probably so high that for all but a select few, I don't even think it should be considered. But in any case, all right. Well, I thank you very much for participating in this, probably a much more practical aspect of expatriation than some of our other discussions, actually affecting a lot more people.
Yes.
This has been great, and we will be back, I guess, in a few days to talk about another very interesting topic.
Okay.
So it's Friday evening in Dubai, if there is such a thing as a weekend in Dubai. Have a great week.
We have a new weekend starting. It's officially started that we should be having Saturday, Sunday. At least that's the government view for the government offices. And many of the private sectors are also going with the now Saturday, Sunday weekend. So we will be having a little bit more of a normal life once that fully kicks in.
Oh, my God. What a change. What a change. All right. Well, this has been great. Thanks very much. And we will pick this up again soon.
Okay, John. And I think what we should do with this one is refer people to the blog post I've written on this. So if they want to review what we discussed.
I will absolutely do that when I put it up. And maybe you want to incorporate this into the post at some point as well.
Sounds great. Okay, John. Thank you. And it was great to talk to you.
All right. Well, have a, so we know that it is, there is such a thing as a weekend now in Dubai. Have a great weekend, Virginia.
Thanks, John. Bye.
Okay.
It's off. Okay, good.